Ensuring that journalists are properly trained seems to me absolutely fundamental to demonstrating to the public that they can trust journalists that they are reading or listening to or seeing.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Media Voices. We're the Media Focus podcast that brings you all the news and the views from the media world that week. I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Hoost. And that quote we opened with was from my interview with Will Gore. He's the head of partnerships and projects at the National Council for the Training of Journalists. Will and I spoke about the NCTJ's role in the Facebook-backed Community News Project, which has funded about 80 journalists in local newsrooms across 9 publishers. We also spoke about journalism education in general, trust, the future of local news, and of course we spoke about shorthand.
Ah, what did we say about shorthand?
Well, it's always that mixed bag thing, isn't it? But it's nice to have.
I have a shorthand.
Well, that leads us wonderfully into today's main topic, small hands.
Oh, it's good we can laugh, isn't it? It's good we can laugh.
Jesus,
oh, sweet. Absolutely correct. Just to pull the curtain back a little bit for the listeners, every week we try to find an angle on that week's news that is specifically applicable to media business models. And I promise you, we try every single week to just not talk about the platforms and politics. But that has been impossible this week. And we have spent the morning raging about everything that's happened. So I think
most of last week arguing, didn't we?
Yeah, that's true.
I think the big thing was trying to find an angle. What does this mean for media?
Particularly because it's, like everything's so bound together now, and it's like, what does this mean for the media? Inevitably has an impact on what does this mean for the public, and what does this mean for the politicians who the media is supposed to be holding to account? And so the lead this week, as if we had a choice, is how it's been a bit of a flashpoint for social platforms, truth, fact-checking and everything, which is Twitter taking on Trump, finally. So the social platform, Twitter, has put its money where its mouth is, and it's now applying its rules to arguably its most prolific user, which is Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, the two of them have been bumping up against each other for a bit. He's been tweeting stuff about postal voting, which is fundamentally untrue. Mm-hmm. Twitter called him to account and put a fact-checking notice on some of his tweets. He tweets out, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. And Twitter has stuck an interstitial over the top of his tweet because they've said, rightly, that it's glorifying violence.
All right, so what Twitter did was, in that specific case, they didn't use the fact-checking interstitial. They used the one that said this is glorifying violence, which means that that tweet then cannot be amplified. It cannot be retweeted. Yeah. It's hidden by default. And effectively, what it is it's applying its rules equally to everybody.
This is not Twitter applying the rules to the same for everybody. If anybody else on that platform tweeted that sort of thing, they would get their account shut down straight away.
Okay, but they had an excuse or a reason for this. What they're saying is removing that tweet is against the public interest because the public needs to know what a hateful orange man baby he is.
Okay.
Well, they didn't say that, but I agree with that point.
And that's the scary part of this. If you ever get... I saw the CNN guy get arrested on Twitter.
Yeah, insane.
That was bad enough. But watching the comments that came in after that was absolutely horrifying. Terry White tweeted, this is a point where institutional racism and anti-media feeling meets.
Yeah.
Because, this guy, he's a black reporter, and it's just awful.
We can discuss that, because we were saying that, before we started recording, we were saying that police brutality against George Floyd it's not a new thing.
No,
there has been systematic racism in the US for as long as the US has existed, effectively. But you were saying that you think that this violence against the media is something that has been emboldened by Trump's rise to power.
Absolutely. I think we talked about Will Smith. I can't remember exactly what Will Smith's quote was, but it's like this kind of racist violence from the police on against black African American people is not new. It's just being filmed. I'm talking as a Scottish white guy, I have no clue what this is like. It just seems absolutely horrendous. So that's that one side of things. Trump has enabled a bunch of stuff around that, but Trump has systematically gone out of his way to undermine respect for the media.
Yeah.
Since day one, he has done that. We're seeing the same shit happen in this country now. The point is, you know, so the scum media hashtag came about because of Dominic Cummings, because of this reaction that the media is just creating this problem. Fucking Dominic Cummings created that problem because he's such an arsehole that he couldn't stay at home. So
how are we back on this already?
Well, because it's the same thing. Yeah. It's absolutely the same thing.
Well, now then, is that not our way back away from this cliff edge of anger? It, because Twitter has been rightly criticised in the past for not doing enough to prevent its algorithms boosting the range of tweets like this in the past. But is this not exactly what the social platforms should be doing when something breaches their terms?
Yes.
But it doesn't, it also, in a sense, it doesn't matter what Twitter does, because the only reason I saw this is because the entirety of the media were talking about it. And they were, you know, this message was hidden, and they were all like, oh, this is the hidden message. And it's like, well, there's such a reaction to everything he posts.
At least then, if the media is reporting on that message, at least they're doing it in, they're putting it in context. Whereas on Twitter, it appears in feed. And they can say, look at this racist thing that Trump has said.
So what's this executive order thing that he's done? I'm not 100% clear on what he's
saying.
So
he's effectively arguing that he's going to remove the protections that social platforms have as any liability for content that is published on that site.
Right. This wouldn't affect just Twitter. This wouldn't affect just the social media platforms. This would also affect, I mean, Chris, Reddit would not function. As would none of the review sites, stuff like Yelp. If Yelp is suddenly liable for something that somebody posts on there, like a bad review, if a restaurant owner can sue somebody, can sue Yelp for a negative review somebody's left, the whole thing falls apart. Like that in itself is completely
UGC
separate.
UGC is just all of a sudden an absolute nightmare.
Also, publishers' comment feeds would be horrendous.
You mentioned Facebook there, and what's Zuckerberg's reaction to this been?
Zuckerberg has come under pressure because Trump generally tends to post the same thing across both platforms, and so the same thing appeared on Facebook's platform, and they did nothing. So Zuckerberg kind of put out like this very weaselly statement explaining Facebook's own lack of action, which was basically like, They defend free speech, and if people want to be arseholes, that's basically their own problem.
Sorry.
go on.
they're cloaking themselves. He's cloaking himself in that like First Amendment defense, but really it's just the ultimate in book passing. There's a fantastic Verge article that's looking into this where Facebook staff have basically wanted to act on the post. And there's this great quote in there that says, "All this points to a very high risk of a violent escalation and civil unrest in November. Jesus. And if we fail the test case here, history will not judge us kindly." And then Zuckerberg went out and just flunked the test by basically saying, oh, maybe I don't agree with Trump, but that doesn't mean that Facebook has to fact check. And then one of the fucking Winklevoss twins.
Oh, I saw that.
Fact checking is a euphemism for editorializing, which is a form of censorship. And that's a fact, full stop. Go yourself.
The best response to that I saw was a tweet in the same thread. You know, a reply when someone said, "It's truly amazing how everyone involved in the founding of Facebook is a pathologically lying sociopath."
I've seen a lot of kind of comments from Facebook employees just being like, "Yeah, I think we're kind of on the wrong side of this one, guys."
That's an interesting one, though. You know, the fact that Google had to deal with the kind of staff backlash, and if Facebook's got to deal with a staff backlash, maybe that'll change some stuff. I don't know.
Possibly.
Also, have you seen the thing with, I guess it's some congressional hearing or something?
Oh, yeah. So it's Zuckerberg at the...
He basically says anyone threatening violence will be removed from the platform.
This is... The issues around this are so, so difficult, because I know he said, I think it was, I don't even know what day it is now, it was like Thursday last week, he said that like basically political speech is key to a democracy, people should be able to see what politicians say, even if those politicians are complete twats. Well, that's not what he said, but that's a paraphrase. And I think it is one of the things that people should be able to get the facts on what public figures are saying. And it's one of the beauties, in a sense, of social media that you can get directly from their mouths. But where would they then stop if they censored it? You know, would they fact check everything?
Well, they should. Someone should fact check everything.
Not everything politicians say can come down to a simple, is it true or not?
That's true. That is true. There is a lot of nuance here. I saw the... But there are some facts that people rely on arguments. I saw the CCO of Snopes saying, we have the expertise to do this. Let us do this.
But I think it was really brought home when I spoke to John Byrne Murdoch a couple of weeks ago. That's working with data. He does the FT's coronavirus charts. And you think, right, data, that's a simple who's died, who hasn't, who's got it, who hasn't. And he said, like, the way that they measure that and the way that they put those charts together, it was a constant editorial decision about what would be fair, because you change the way you measure something, or you change the measurements, or the country changes what they're doing, and it suddenly makes a country look better or makes a country look worse. Or, you know, if somebody's died of a heart attack but had coronavirus, does that count? And it's even data is not objective, and you can't, like, what is truth?
I completely agree, but you can be transparent about the reasons you have done that. And if you are transparent about the reasons you've made the editorial decisions you have, then at least people can, and you make them consistently, then at least people can use that as like a baseline, you know?
Yeah. I think my position on this generally is that Twitter's action to fact check Trump's first tweet was sensible and right. If he then broke Twitter's rules in the second one, he should have been banned, and Zuckerberg needs to get off his ass and do something.
I mean, what Esther's saying is right, but people who tell other people to kill other people should be stopped. The end.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is why Trump shouldn't be tweeting for the next 14 days.
Not to be a massive downer or anything. I think for the first time in a Media Voices podcast, I feel completely hopeless. Yeah. And helpless, actually. I don't feel like there's anything we can do.
We can turn it all off. Turn everything off.
I hate to say, throw a couple of Molotovs.
Well,
burn the f***ing place down.
Right now.
Twitter's going to switch you off for that, mate.
Yeah, Chris, that's a 14-day podcast ban.
Yeah, definitely.
We're not going to come to a conclusion on this. I think we've effectively said potential calamitous repercussions for publishers if Trump's executive order, even though it's massively illegal.
Yeah, he can't do it.
No, he can't. Does effectively go to, you know, does make publishers liable for comments on their own pages. But in the meantime, just please fucking be safe and kind to one another. It's trite. It's so fucking trite to say that, but it's the only thing I can think that's given me any hope at the moment.
It's the best anything we've got right now.
News in brief. Morgan News, then.
This is just a car crash of a news in brief.
No, it's a car crash of a civilization.
Yeah, I guess. So Microsoft, you remember those guys?
Vaguely.
I don't know. Developing vaccines with chips in it, apparently.
Like gravy chips?
No, little Microsoft chips that will
track chips,
you. You can get some chips.
Oh, our fish and chip shop opened up this week.
Honestly, at this point, I just think hedonism is the only sane response.
I think you're probably
anyway,
right.
Chips aside.
Crack open so,
so Microsoft is replacing its journalists, human being journalists, with algorithms.
I have a little bit of a counterpoint on this.
Go on.
I think calling, and this might sound really harsh, but this is just from the story I read on this, calling them journalists is a bit of a stretch.
No, they're taking editorial decisions.
Yeah.
What they essentially did was, they're curators. They decided which stories from other places that they would then essentially pay to host on the MSN homepage. Well, they weren't actually like writing or reporting or doing anything like that.
Journalism is curation.
Yeah, I was going to say,
we are having the existential questions today.
But I mean, the best response I saw at this was from Chris Moran, the innovations guy, editorial innovations guy at The Guardian.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that one of the things that really winds him up about this is that taking tech into journalism is fine because it takes out really boring or really complex database jobs. You're never going to get that editorial, what you've just said, Chris, that human news judgment. That just takes us down exactly the same bullshit rabbit hole that we've been on with Twitter and Facebook.
Yeah.
The algorithm decides what you see.
Shall I cheer you up with the next story?
I wish it did, but it doesn't.
Yeah, nothing does. Print advertising revenues at DMGT have fallen by 70%. And so this is the publisher that owns Mail Online and the Mail on Sunday. They've also said that total revenues across their consumer media division were down by a third in April. So, yeah, not good.
No. I mean, they own, Metro? So this goes far beyond just... This goes far, far beyond just the print side of things as well. And it won't be...
Oh, that's just a cheering is up story.
Why? People are going to lose their jobs.
No, that's what I'm saying. I thought it was meant to be a cheering is up story.
Oh, I see.
That was deep sarcasm.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Well, you know what? I'm looking further down the list, and there are a few good news stories, so let's just rattle through. So, well, this one's not. But the BBC received nearly 40,000 complaints over the Maitlis affair. So after Emily Maitlis made a very straightforward statement about Dominic Cummings, on Newsnight, the BBC received nearly 40,000 complaints. Ah, but here's where you can argue the BBC is actually doing its job well, because 20,000 were complaints about the statement itself, but 20,000 of the other ones were effectively defending Maitlis.
That's balance, right?
It is balance. And is the BBC doing its job, unless it's pissing... Ooh, tens of thousands of people off in equal measure.
So, Rafa Ali, who we love on this podcast and who's been a guest in the past, has announced the big changes at Skift because it's given up its offices when the lease runs out, I believe, in July. It's going to this connected view of office working, which basically means there's no office.
The rest of it's a good news story because they are launching an LGBTQ+ editorial product. Yeah, so they're launching the Queer 50 editorial product, which is designed to celebrate the work of LGBTQ+ people within the industry, which is necessary. There wouldn't be this much shit in the world if the people who deserve visibility were more visible.
Be kind, people.
Hmm. More good news. City AM, which is a free business newspaper distributed in London and other cities, is returning to print in September.
Mm-hmm.
So they're coming back from Monday the 7th of September. They'd obviously suspended distribution due to the coronavirus, but during that time they'd made no redundancies. Yeah. So well done, guys.
Boom.
It can be done. Oh, but it can't at Playboy. Because Playboy has laid off pretty much all of its editorial staff. And Esther, actually, I want to throw it to you on this one, because you're the one who flagged this up, and you're the one who's actually been all over Playboy for the... Not all over. You know what I mean?
I messed up.
So, Esther, you've been the one who's been keeping an eye on this story for quite some time. That's a better way to say it.
Thank you.
So, in March, they stopped their print editions altogether, but they were going to transition to digital. What happened?
I don't like. So the story on this is a little bit sparse, but they seem to have basically they've pivoted away from their pivot. So they pivoted to digital first publishing, but they've now gone and fired all of their editorial staff. That's pretty much 25 staff that have gone. And I just give a shout out to Brian Morrissey here, who just gave my favourite tweet this week, which, you know, there's not a lot of competition for that.
Low bar this week.
There are probably no pivots left for Playboy, so it's time to go all in on licensing and milk the brand.
Yeah.
So this is a good news story.
A silver lining story.
So there's obviously internships have been hit by the coronavirus and lockdown. As a response to that, The Information has launched a news summer school described as a 4-week boot camp. It's free and it's aimed at people who were going to have internships but can't because of the lockdown. The idea is to help people build a career in news. It's a great idea, obviously, but the lineup is insane.
Yeah, it's really
good. I want to join the lineup and I'm not even an intern.
And it's international. You don't have to be in the States.
It ended up being a lot more valuable for some of those people than an internship would ever have been.
Yeah, I mean, the people they're talking about, it's Peter Kafka at Recode, Lydia Paul Green at Gimlet, Kevin Delaney from Quartz, Jessica Lesson herself. I'd love to go to some of these.
We can send you to summer camp if you want.
Yeah, can I go? Please.
Or do some canoeing.
Please, can I go to summer camp? This week I spoke to Will Gore from the NCTJ. We talked about journalism education, the future of local news, and how the media can build trust again. But first I asked Will about the Facebook-backed Community News Project.
Yes, so the Community News Project was a scheme set up Well, it was launched in 2019, based on an agreement that had been made in 2018 between Facebook, the NCTJ, which is the National Council for the Training of Journalists, and 9 regional news publishers. And the idea, in a nutshell, was that Facebook would fund the hiring of up to 80 community news reporters who would work for those various publishers. And each of those reporters would be handed a 2-year contract. And during that 2 years, they would also study for an NCTJ qualification. Right. So in most cases, that's the diploma in journalism, which is the, I suppose, the key pre-entry qualification, which most students do before they begin their careers, but a number of students do while they are sort of in their initial stages, for example, if they're doing an apprenticeship. And then some of the community news reporters are studying for the higher level NQJ qualification, which is the sort of the senior journalist qualification, if you like.
So in terms of the NCTJ's role in that, do you see that as a way of making sure that the people that are in these roles have the sort of education that you've been providing for years and years and years, but that's then funded separately?
Yes, I mean, I think the NCTJ's role is, you know, twofold. One, we are essentially managing the project. You know, I think Facebook rightly felt that it was more awkward and I suppose raised, you know, potentially difficult questions if it was going to directly fund publishers. So the NCTJ manages the project from a financial point of view, but absolutely our additional interest in all of this is around integrating training with, you know, on the job learning, which I think is something which we know is effective because of apprenticeships, but this is an interesting and alternative way to do that.
So Facebook, I guess, in some ways sees you as an honest broker. You know, you can sit between them and the news organizations. Is Facebook also interested in that, what I guess is that kind of benchmark for quality journalism?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, that is certainly a key factor in all of this, and I think the NCTJ has always provided that benchmark. You know, it is an industry backed charity. It's existed for 70 years, has very much evolved with the times. You know, it obviously its background was very much in print journalism, but now is you know, equally focused on digital and broadcast. So I think the NCTJ as a benchmark is a hugely useful factor in all this. And I think particularly at the moment when you've got and have had over a number of years this sort of debate about trust in news, quality, you know, ensuring that journalists are properly trained seems to me absolutely fundamental to demonstrating to the public that they can trust journalists that they are reading or listening to or seeing.
What do you think that looks like now, though? What does a properly trained journalist look like?
Well, I mean, you know, it probably takes a number of forms, doesn't it? But I think there is that, you know, there are some fundamentals about journalism which remain unchanged in terms of how you get a story, what you understand to be a story, in fact, I suppose at the outset, how you get the story, how you frame the story, how you contextualize it, and how you present it. And all of those things, you know, they sound like things that anyone can do. And with a bit of training, no doubt that's perhaps true, but it's not as easy as it looks. And I know from my own experience, having ended up in a newsroom through a slightly odd route, with my background was in media regulation, I realised on the very, very rare occasions that I ended up writing a news story. And I think I did it about twice because I realised immediately that I just really couldn't do it because I hadn't had the kind of training that NCDJ trained journalists have. So I was able to write an op-ed because, you know, I could write and I could, you know, give a reasoned point of view. But when it came to actually structuring and presenting a news story, it's genuinely very hard.
Yeah, the reporting aspect of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that those fundamentals do remain unchanged. And of course, an awful lot of other stuff has changed drastically around technology, both in terms of how journalists use technology to produce their work, but also how they use technology to, you know, to actually gain stories in the first place. So that has to be built into the training as well. So it's trying to combine those two factors, I suppose.
I think the thing that always comes up when there's that conversation about the NCTJ's training and, you know, the evolution aspect of it is this idea of shorthand. And it's just this big thing of, oh, why is anyone even bothering learning shorthand? And then there's all these people pile on that say, but shorthand's amazing. I use it every day. It's wonderful.
You know, the truth of the matter is that shorthand does remain very, very useful for an awful lot of journalists. And if you want to be a court reporter, then you have to have shorthand. And if you want to have a foolproof way of recording an interview when your dictaphone breaks down, then really you have to have shorthand. So, I mean, I do genuinely believe that shorthand is hugely valuable to an awful lot of journalists. I mean, I think that sometimes the debate around shorthand does cloud broader issues.
I think that's my point. It's a real distraction, I think.
I think, you know, it can be, yes.
The point is exactly what I think you're talking about, is a fundamental skill set of reporting and properly sourcing a story. And I think one of the things I think I wonder about, you know, maybe you can talk about, is the idea that there's kind of this, there's almost a contradiction in what you're training people to do and what publishers or news publishers want them to do. You know, that idea of cut and paste that people complain about so much in newspapers, particularly in digital.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think, you know, it's always easy to find an example of journalism that, you know, that doesn't meet the standards you would think it ought to do, because they're the kind of examples that people jump on very quickly, circulate on social media, and everyone says, oh, well, you know, journalism's not what it used to be. I don't really accept that that is true. I mean, I think you can always, you know, you look at any period of time, pick up a newspaper from 30 years ago, flick through the pages, and you will find journalism that is not brilliant. You know, it's always existed. But I think now it's much easier for people to amplify the examples which they think are not great. Actually, my view is that, and I think the Community News Project is a great example of this, is that there is a hell of a lot of really very, very good journalism out there. And I'm not just talking about, you know, the sort of the groundbreaking investigations or the exclusive interviews or the amazing scoops. You know, there is an awful lot of really good day-to-day general reporting going on for which journalists get remarkably little credit. And I think we've seen that as part of the CMP, where, you know, you've got journalists out in communities that have perhaps been underserved for a while, and they're just getting good stories.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're not necessarily stories that are going to make national headlines, but they're meaningful stories for local readers and local audiences. And I think that's really important. So I don't think there is a contradiction between what we're teaching and what publishers want. I think all publishers want journalists who can produce good journalism and can adapt to the markets that they're working in. And be flexible in the way they produce journalism too.
I think a brilliant example of that was the post that was on Medium behind local news. It was a week in the life of a community news reporter, and it was talking about a lady called Rebecca Beardmore on the Blackpool Gazette.
I think that is exactly right. And, you know, she is just one of, you know, what is it, 77, 78 community news reporters who are in post, who are doing a really difficult job in really difficult circumstances, who are also studying for a qualification. Many of them have other responsibilities. You know, she's a sort of, you know, emblematic of that in that she's got three kids. Yeah. I think they're 2, 7, and 10. She's trying to do her job from home. She's trying to, you know, revise for NCTJ exams. I mean, this is really tough stuff. And yet she's doing it willingly. She's doing it well. And it really makes me so angry when you hear flippant criticism of journalists or journalism, or even, you know, the kind of stuff that you get from time to time where people just talk down, particularly the regional press, and just say, oh, well, you know, it's been a failing model for years and years, and coronavirus is going to be the thing that finishes it all off. And I just think, well, no, yes, of course, there are massive challenges, massive structural economic challenges facing the sector. But it is innovative. It is full of good people who work really hard. And, you know, they will, I'm sure, find ways through these tough times. Mm. So I find it, and I sort of resent, you know, a lot of the talking down of the sector, because usually it comes from people who either don't know it very well, or perhaps knew it a long time ago and, you know, have got their rose-tinted spectacles on. And I think an awful lot of it is frankly not very accurate.
You think part of the problem, though, is that some of the chains have reduced local people, you know, people on the ground, the number of people that they actually have on the ground. So to talk about local news is actually, in some organisations, is a little bit of a misnomer, because they've got one person in a hub covering four or five different areas.
Well, I mean, I think everyone would acknowledge that, you know, most local regional newspapers don't have the resources that they once had. But I think the Community News Project is an example of what can be achieved when you get those people back in communities. And clearly, you know, the economic situation makes that difficult. But I think, you know, that's kind of where we have to look. Look to see the kind of future of local news is engaging with communities, being relevant, as, you know, local media always has tried to be.
What do you think that looks like when we start to get this new normal that people talk about after the pandemic?
Well, I think perhaps it does need to be, you know, even more community focused than it, you know, perhaps ever has been. Because I think that is what makes local news outlets distinct, is that they speak to those community audiences. Yeah. And I think part of that, you know, also taps into the idea that local newsrooms, just as national newsrooms across all sectors of the industry, you know, need to make even more of an effort to represent their audiences in terms of being diverse themselves. You know, that's something else that the Community News Project has been very successful in. And I think 69% of the reporters hired as part of this scheme fit one or more of the various diversity criteria that were set. Now, we, you know, there was no sort of, this isn't a kind of, you know, quota system that was set, put in place, but there was certainly an ambition at the outset of the project to try and attract a diverse intake. That is one of the reasons that the project has been an enormous success, because I think what audiences have seen and what communities have seen is that there are journalists out there who actually are just like them, you know, and because they come from those communities. And I think, you know, there's always been an element of that in local news, of course. But I think, you know, increasingly, and we've seen this over the last few years, to be fair, it's got to be quite an explicit effort. And certainly that fits with the NCTJ's broader diversity aims. You know, as you probably know, we run the Journalism Diversity Fund, which helps people from diverse backgrounds study on our courses. So I think that's another element of what local news needs to look like. It needs to be as representative of its audiences as it possibly can.
But do you think it also needs to be where they are? You know, maybe that doesn't mean print anymore. It means Facebook.
Well, I mean, maybe, but I think it's easy to write print off, isn't it? And I think there are still an awful lot of people out there who like nothing better than picking up a physical newspaper and reading it cover to cover. And yeah, sure, those readership numbers have declined, and you know, maybe that decline will continue, maybe it won't, who knows. But I wouldn't write it off completely. I think that there is still a place of print, undoubtedly. But ultimately, you know, it all comes down to good journalism, doesn't it? And it doesn't massively matter what the platform is, as long as audiences are engaging with it.
Yeah, and I guess as long as it can be sustainable financially, somehow, however, yes, whatever that looks like.
Well, absolutely, and you know that is the million or no doubt multi-billion dollar question, isn't it?
Yeah.
But you know, to a certain extent, that has been so for 20 years. Yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, when I worked for the Press Complaints Commission, you know, I'd go along to industry conferences, and you know, you'd have sort of panel sessions asking what is the future of journalism, as you know, as you always get at these conferences, and you know, people would chat about the internet and the impact of, you know, on news, and you know, no one really knew what the answers were then. I think we've inched towards answers in the meantime, but you know, things change so rapidly. And you know, obviously the current crisis has been completely unexpected and unprecedented, but notwithstanding that, you know, things have changed rapidly and unexpectedly in terms of the tech, in terms of audiences, and I think news organizations have simply to be ever more innovative and flexible in terms of reaching audiences and finding ways to monetize them, frankly.
So I just read a piece, well, last week in the Press Gazette, kind of blaming Google and Facebook for the demise of BuzzFeed News in the UK. You're coming at this from a different point of view than the Press Gazette. I don't agree with the Press Gazette's necessarily the duopoly campaign, but I get it. I know where they're coming from. But you're coming at that from a different point of view. Is there how do you deal with that idea, that scepticism, if you like, of Facebook's motivation in this kind of space?
Yeah, I mean, I think that scepticism obviously, you know, exists and is strong in some quarters, less strong in others. I mean, I think the, you know, the antipathy towards the big tech companies is oversimplified. I mean, you know, it goes without saying, I mean, no one is going to disagree with the notion that the successful business models of Facebook, Google, and the others, but those in particular, have, you know, caused massive disruption to existing news media organizations. But I don't think that is the only factor in the challenges that the news media organizations have faced. And I think to a certain extent, Google and Facebook have, you know, provided new ways for those organizations to reach audiences. So, I think you can debate till the cows come home whether there is sufficient transparency around, you know, ad spend and ad revenue, whether there is a sufficient share going back to publishers. And I think those are very legitimate questions to be asked. But I do think some of the, you know, the antipathy is overdone, and obviously from the point of view of the Community News Project, you know, that is one example among quite a number of projects, schemes, programs that Facebook, Google, and others have supported, which directly help journalism. And I totally get the idea that some people will have that. It's simply a way for Facebook and Google to get some good PR and to, in a sense, cover their backs. You know, that's an easy contention to make. But I think actually there are many people at those two companies who completely acknowledge the disruption that has been caused to local media, who totally understand that actually news is an enormous driver of their own brand successes, and that journalism is important. So I think the idea that it's only a PR trick is just not sustainable. You know, A, this is actually helping journalism in the UK. You know, this isn't a fig leaf. This is a successful project. And B, you know, the people at Facebook and Google who are backing projects like the Community News Project have a genuine belief in the importance of journalism. So I get the skepticism, and you know, I understand where it's coming from, but I think it's just too easy to be a skeptic and to not acknowledge that actually there's a lot of positivity behind projects like this one.
One of the issues we got is this idea, you mentioned it earlier actually, trust. You know, trust in journalism, mm-hmm. trust in publishers, trust in platforms. There's just this whole sort of public mistrust, if you like. How do you see your role from the NCTJ's point of view in trying to help fix that through education, or actually journalism education more generally?
Mm. I think it's something that the NCTJ is very, very conscious of. My career has been, a slightly odd one, but the factor which holds it all together from, you know, my decade in regulation, self-regulation, through nearly a decade in newsrooms, and then out the other side to the NCTJ, the common factor in all of that has been around standards and quality and trust. And I think the NCTJ has this very significant role to play in all of that, both in terms of continuing to train student journalists to a high standard, but also I think, you know, there is a much bigger role for us to play in the, if you like, the continuous professional development of journalists once they've got into work. Because, you know, I've always been aware that that is an area that is patchy at best. You know, there are some news organisations which I think are excellent, and, you know, they make a real point of keeping their staff up to date with new developments, new skills and so on. Other organisations are not very good, and some are in the middle. And I think the NCTJ, which has always been in that sphere to an extent, in that, you know, we run scheduled training for journalists, we run bespoke courses for news organisations that want us to develop them for them. But I still think there is a bigger role for the NCTJ to play in that sort of continuous development of journalists throughout their careers. And I think that's the area where we are currently looking to expand into. Because I think, you know, the NCTJ's record when it comes to training students is terrific. And, you know, it has built its reputation on that. But I think moving more compellingly into the in-work training sphere, that is something that we are aiming to do. And I think it absolutely speaks to that question of trust in journalism more broadly.
Do you think it's a skills thing, or do you think it's a PR thing, or do you think it's both?
Oh, I think it's probably a bit of both. I think there is a skills element to it, which is partly around, I suppose, the rapid advances in technology, which journalists, you know, frankly, do need to keep abreast of if they're to do their jobs to the best of their potential. I think it's not only about technology. I think it's also about understanding developments in audience behavior. I think it's understanding developments in even things as sort of as basic but essential as media law and media regulation, media ethics. You know, those are things that change over time. And if you don't actually take the opportunity occasionally to update your knowledge about that, it's very easy to become out of date. But yes, I'm sure there's a PR angle as well, in the sense that the journalism industry has always had a problem at sort of explaining to the public why they can be trusted. And I think it's often sort of asserted, but actually I think pointing to training, pointing to codes of ethics, those are the kinds of things which actually make a difference, and which can combat that narrative of mistrust, which has, I think, very unfairly, for the most part, taken hold in recent times, and has taken hold in part because it has suited the agendas of some other people. I include politicians in that. Absolutely. To an extent, to sow that seed of doubt.
Yeah. Well, on that front, if you had to recommend a really good piece of journalism for our listeners, what would it be?
Well, I mean, I think the obvious thing I ought to do is recommend McNay's Media Law Handbook as being the perfect guide for all journalists, and I think it would be not a bad thing if an awful lot of members of the public read it too, not least to understand what journalists have to know before they embark on their trade.
So we are now a month into our Media Voices Daily Media Roundup, which is our daily newsletter bringing you the top 3 to 4 stories that you need to know every day. We've had loads of really great feedback from it, so thank you so much to everybody who has sent that. I think we just want to be concise, which is what we are not on the podcast. But yeah, it's just, if you want to sign up, go to voices.media and there'll be a nice little pop-up box.
That's on the website, obviously, voices.media, and there's all sorts of stuff on there. There's stuff we've written, there's all previous episodes. How many, guys?
145 now.
145 episodes, all sorts of guests. You can listen along. There's transcripts and there's pictures of us if you want to see what we look like.
Well, you can also follow us for our cheery demeanors on social. You can find us all together on Twitter at Media Voices.
You can find us rage tweeting on Twitter.
We try to be constructive. Or you can find us all individually. So I'm at Chris M. Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Keziah T.
And I'm at flipping_pages.
Very nice. But until next week, please do stay safe.
Be kind.
Try to be kind. Yeah. Try to find anything to be happy
deeply
about. Yeah. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.